Torah isn't education, it's transformation. This is Chai Chinuch with Rabbi G.
101.9 Chai FM, Chai Chinuch, Rabbi G. We are back, as we do every Monday between 2 to 3, where we discuss education, but we also discuss different methods of therapy, what we could learn, what we need to know to improve our lives and our communities and our safety on every level. Everything we need to know and learn and achieve to create the world we actually want to live in. So influencing our families, our friends, our communities, our neighbors, and just bringing the world to the place to be, or to bring ourselves to be at the place we want in order to have the society and the life that we need and make sure it happens. And today we're going to talk about a very important topic, which is a bit maybe different than always the regular topics. However, we will bring the therapeutical angle in as well with a psychologist. But before we go that, let me just explain, because today we all are celebrating, hopefully, Rosh Chodesh Av, which is the first day of the month of Av. And you know, probably as my listeners, you know that in the past 9-10 years, I don't usually mention the Jewish calendar, but today I am. Because according to our belief, we all know that the 9 days between the first day of Av, which is today, and the next 9 days are days that are considered potentially dangerous for the Jewish nation, for us, and therefore we are inquired to be extra careful, extra vigilant, look around, be aware of what's happening, and we are even avoiding any extreme dangerous things. I mean, if you're going to do some bungee, or if you get a thrill jumping off a plane, this is not the week to do it. We will wait for another 2 weeks. So in the next 9 days, these are days that, besides for the historical part of Tisha B'Av and the 9 days and the mourning of the temple and everything from a religious point of view, it is considered as days that are potential for danger are much higher. And therefore, the most natural way, and much natural thing which we're going to address today, is crime and danger. And what is happening, and what is the reality, and what are we actually looking out for? Because if we're commanded to look out and be extra careful these days, even though we probably have to do that every day, all the time, which you'll hear from my professional guests, as they know that much more than me, but what is really the reality and what is happening? So for that discussion, I have three professionals, each one in their area. We'll start with our first guest today. His name is Karim Senga. He is the head of legal and investigation in the Corruption Watch. And let's first get an understanding of what is the reality of South Africa today, what's happening, where are we at with our crime compared to before, and a bit about what you do. Good afternoon, Karim. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me on the program.
Okay, so a bit about your position, your job, what you do before we go, your organization, Corruption Watch, and then we'll go into the discussion.
Thank you. I'm actually the executive director at Corruption Watch. I was previously head of legal and investigations. Corruption Watch is a civil society, nonprofit organization based in South Africa. We work in the social justice sector on various initiatives, contributing to the fight against corruption. The organization was formed in 2012 at a time when there was a great concerns that we had a rising corruption challenge in the country. That was certainly borne out, particularly in the years under Jacob Zuma. We know we've had a hotly contested national election now where corruption is one of the big hot button issues. So we're really an advocacy organization, fighting for initiatives to help improve the situation, whether it be new laws, whether it be strengthening up institutions, looking at the overall response from the country in the fight against corruption and seeing what we can do to improve the situation.
Amazing. What would you say is the link that we're seeing between corruption in the government or high-level people and powers and stress to the simple crime that we meet on day-to-day life? What is the link that we need to be aware of and look out for? And is there a link? Maybe potentially it's just two very important issues that we need to deal with. How would you see it?
Yeah, so I think that there certainly are linkages, and your listeners will be aware of this kind of idea around organized crime or syndicated criminal activity involving networks of individuals, not just single people, but people that are involved in different kinds of networks. And this is where corruption comes in, because we see that there's a lot of organized crime which is targeting public sector institutions, targeting the procurement systems, for instance, at a provincial department of health or at a other kind of a public entity. So there are these linkages between organized crime on the one hand and kind of rampant, what you'd call almost systemic corruption, which has creeped into our system, which we see, which we saw at the state-owned enterprises. We've seen it at ESCOM, at Transnet. We see it across the public sector. We see it in local government. So yeah, there are absolutely these linkages. In terms of, the day-to-day, there are other kinds of criminal activity out there, extortion rackets, people involved in drugs and human trafficking. And in many cases, the sense is that these are people that are also have their links into different types of corruption networks as well.
Wow. Okay. So actually, I didn't even think of when you say human trafficking, it just struck me that just about 2 days ago, there was a message going around about potentially arrest and rescue here in the area. I don't know if Michael knows a bit more about it or can comment, but I want to add into our discussion. I have in studio here is Michael, who is the head of the Communities and Communication and Care Center at CAP. And are seeing CAP is obviously the organization that is seeing the crime on the other side, on the day-to-day life, on the hijackings and the home invasions and anything to the immediate crime that we see. And we'll see from his side in the link. So firstly, good afternoon, Michael. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, a bit about your job, your position.
So I am head of CAP Communities and the care department. CAP Communities relates to the number of areas that we take care of in terms of our proactive crime prevention model, and CAP Care is related to our service inquiries, queries, complaints and compliments that come through to us via email, call in and so on a daily basis, just looking after all of our clients and making sure that they are happy and responded to.
What is the reality today? What are we facing on crime in our communities that's potentially we're not even aware of because of your work or because of Karim's work that we're not getting exposed to? What do we need to know?
Well, I think very importantly, one of the founding principles of CAP was to essentially eradicate violent crime in our residential area, specifically in the Johannesburg area. And we really focus on trying to eliminate violent crime in our communities. You know, violent crime has probably the biggest impact in terms of societal impact, in terms of impact on people leaving the country, in terms of their psychological state and trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, and so on. And it is an incredibly socially disruptive phenomenon that causes significant amount of damage, not only to the victims of that crime, but to the environment itself. So we've always focused mainly on violent crime, and what we really try to prevent in our areas are not only the crimes that are opportunistic in nature, but also crimes that are reconnoitered, or there is some kind of a forward planning around the crime. We find, very importantly, residents have a significant role to play in avoiding opportunistic crime and in eliminating themselves, A, as a target, and B, the potential opportunity around those crimes. But we monitor all kinds of crimes in our areas, including soft crimes, but really we believe the focus should be on violent crimes in our communities and in the greater community in general in terms of South Africa.
Okay. So going into violent crimes, and as a citizen, you know, we're sitting here, the three of us, and so we're going to have the therapist join us as well. But in our discussion, there's each one of us has a role, obviously. Yes. And, you know, I'm looking at your amazing role, Michael, you know, what you're doing in the streets and in the community, in the city, specifically Johannesburg, managing to protect the community. And you mentioned about the residents and responsibility of our residents, of us as me, the simple man and the simple person in the street, what I can do to be aware, be vigilant, etc. But a lot of it has to do with the amazing work Karim's doing, which is the corruption, because it's much harder for a citizen to actually take the time and go to the police and ask for protection and go report to the authorities and go be there when you don't trust the authorities and you don't feel that the people are there. Sure. So what would you say is the direct link between the three of us in this discussion right now? What would you define? And then I'll go to you, Karim, and say, what are the links that we need to all take? So, Michael, what would be the links that you would want us as the people, you as the organization that is protecting, and Karim, who's helping, who's managing it on a, I guess, minister, government, organizational level?
That's a very interesting question. First and foremost, corruption is a integral part of the continuation of criminality in terms of the fact that a lot of suspects are out and about on the street either due to some level of corruption or incompetence. So corruption plays a part in all kinds of crimes within our criminal justice system and the prosecution of those crimes. And CAP itself monitors all our cases that we get because of the fact that we're so aware of the potential for corruption to eliminate justice for the victim and for the person that has been exposed to this violent crime. So I think one thing that binds the work that we do with the other gentleman from the organization in terms of corruption is
Corruption
that
Watch.
Corruption Watch, excuse me, thank you. Is that we really are cognizant of the fact that in a corrupt system, it is very difficult for everyone involved to get an outcome that is favorable towards justice. It also creates issues like recidivism, and I'm sure it has a lasting impact in terms of repeat offenders again and again coming out in and attempting to disrupt the community through crime. We specifically are guarded against that by our own legal department that follows each of our cases, especially violent crime, to conclusion where possible and monitors the outcomes because of the fact that there is corruption.
Amazing. Well, we do need to take a ad break, but it's finding it fascinating that you, Michael, are managing and investigating the crimes, but that's in a way when we as citizens have met it already. And many times I think Karim and his team are working on the crimes before we have actually seen it, as the resident in South Africa is not really always aware of what's happening. And that also has probably a level of prevention because you are doing it on a much earlier stage in a way before it reaches the streets.
I'm
totally sorry. Karim, I'll come back to you right after the break so we can hear your side, and then we'll introduce the psychologist as well into this short break, and we will be right back.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
101.9 Chai FM, Chai Chinuch. We are back, and we are here in a fascinating discussion regarding crime. As I said in the beginning, in the opening, we are in very sensitive days. We all know, as the Jewish community, the first 10 days of Av are the times of worry, concern, time of looking out for the crime, time of making sure we are safe physically, and we really need to invest and be aware and create that vigilancy. In studio, I have with me here Michael, who is the head of operations in CAP and head of care in CAP and the communities, as well as the therapist, which we'll introduce soon. And we have here online is Karim Singa, who is the head of, so it used to be the head of legal investigations and now is the leader and head of Corruption Watch, managing it all. Your angle, Karim, from where the three of us come into play, and maybe even the therapeutical side of things. And then kind of, maybe you can comment on one more thing that I'm just add to it, which I'm very curious, is throughout the years that you've been working, you know, you mentioned even times that you were there with Zuma times, etc. Do you find that your work is already influencing us, so that people are starting maybe after the elections to feel a bit more confident in the system and to actually approach and connect and protect our communities that way?
Yeah, I think it's a bit early to be overly optimistic, but I do think the elections are quite telling in terms of the, you know, the ANC getting such a reduced majority on the basis that, you know, the electorate has associated them with years of maladministration, corruption, and bad governance. It's really challenging. You know, corruption, like most crime, happens behind closed doors. If nobody speaks out, it's not revealed. But certainly when there are corrupt schemes that are going on at a department, you know, within a particular institution, it's generally the case that there will be observers, or there will be people who see what's going on. And I think what we want to try to get to in terms of a culture shift in the country is people feeling comfortable to be able to speak out and to blow the whistle or to report corruption. Then the question comes back to, who do they report to, and how do we rebuild this kind of a culture of trust within our institutions that are responsible for investigating corruption? And I think that's really one of the big challenges we sit with in South Africa, is this sense that the police itself has been an institution which has been riddled with corruption. When the regular person goes into a police station, they can't always be confident that their matter is going to be investigated, that they're going to be protected, that there won't be some kind of retribution against them. So, you know, you began to talk about the need for a preventative framework. I think that's a lot of what we're talking about, too, in terms of the institutional response, that we have, that we can build a preventative response, create that kind of trust with institutions that people can speak out and can blow the whistle. Whether that's about reforming the police, which is not going to be a quick win, or is about trying to create some new institutions, potentially, for instance, like a whistleblower protection agency, is something that Judge Zondo recommended in terms of the Zondo Commission. And I think that's something that we need to give some consideration to. You know, on the psychosocial side, whistleblowers do suffer from, are under a lot of pressure. They are victimized. They do suffer trauma, and, you know, then have those cases for years in terms of, you know, post-traumatic stress disorders. So when we talk about an enhanced whistleblower protection system, we also need to give some attention to providing the actual whistleblowers with that type of support when it's required.
So on the whistleblowers concept, we have a hope potentially that something that will also help the whistleblower is the fact that as a society, we can respect what they've done and we can respect what they sacrificed in order to get rid of corruption and get the country to be in a better place. Is the concept that we're familiar in South Africa of Ampipi affecting that? And are we in a reality that the Ampipi culture is stronger than the protection that we're getting by the authorities? And do we need to create some kind of societal system that will actually campaign against the Ampipi concept, or create an alternative concept of actually thanking the heroes and the whistleblowers?
I think that's absolutely right. And that's part of the culture shift that I'm talking about. So, you know, if you think about the struggle against apartheid, you know, the police were at the front end of that, and nobody wanted to be seen as being a collaborator or in cooperation with the police. We're 30 years on from that. We live in a democracy that's based upon the rule of law, where we're meant to be trusting of the police and working with the police. But I do think that, you know, getting over this kind of culture of impimpies and that speaking out is problematic is part of the culture shift that we have to make. And it's about talking about what it means to have integrity, what it means to, you know, live in a society where we respect the rule of law.
Michael, what can we do on the ground? And specifically, you know, Karim ended off with respecting the rule of law. And I'm wondering if part of the crime has to do also with how we respect the rule of law. Meaning if potentially in certain neighborhoods, people that are very crime-free and respectful don't always realize that when a robot is red, that it actually means you need to stop. Or don't always realize, right. Does that affect also the other kinds of crime?
I think more specifically, in terms of what can we do on the ground, which speaks to the topic, is if you see something, say something. We find time and time again in every single one of our areas that we take care of, that the more the community calls us, and when I say community, I mean anyone with that in that environment, not just a client, not just a contributor, not just someone that we have an existing relationship with, but any person within that environment calls in a crime. We find the more calls we receive in terms of preemptive calls to say, excuse me, listen, I saw two people in a vehicle that were acting suspiciously on the corner of our street. I saw three men walking down the road with bags in their hands that I've never seen before. I saw this happen. I saw that happen. The more calls like that we receive, the less crime there is in that area, full stop. So in one way, CAP kind of celebrates people talking about crime, actively promoting the use of your phone to literally prevent crime in your neighborhood. So many serious or violent crimes that were going to happen have been stopped because one person decided to make a phone call. And that's really what I think we should talk to, the power of a person's voice and the capacity for them to literally change the environment in which they live.
So I want to touch on that from another angle, which is we will need our trauma therapist to join in for that. So just let's get to know her, and then I'll ask the question. Julia Schill is a trauma counselor and an EMDR therapist. Good afternoon, Julia. Julia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
A bit of your work as a trauma therapist within the crime area?
So primarily, when I do see clients, the first thing I like to do is what we call containment. And by that, I actually focus on what's been going on in their body, because there is such a link between trauma and the body. They, in fact, are inseparable. So you need to make your client feel safe. That's the first thing. And they need to feel they can trust you. And you also need to understand that trauma is very different for each person. We all experience it differently. There's no unique way to react to trauma. But there are specific reactions, bodily reactions, that are completely out of your control. And when you understand this, when you have the psychoeducation around this, clients kind of leave saying, I wish it hadn't taken me so long to come to you, or gee, I'm not going crazy, that's normal. So those kind of things can be not being able to sleep, having intrusive thoughts when you're not wanting it. It just happens to come upon you.
So, Julia, before we go into the trauma itself, yeah, and after the crime happens, etc., you know, you mentioned the concept of the physical sensation and physical feelings and reaction, and there's a sense.
Yes.
And what I'm wondering, and this is going back to what Michael commented about, we know, if we take an example, a very interesting report I saw from the Israeli police, that they spoke about that in Israel, one of the biggest challenges they have is terrorist attacks. And they spoke about the concept that many times the terrorists come on their own, hidden, nobody knows. And still, in the moments before the attack, the amount of phone calls coming into the police are extremely high. They identify every time that many, many citizens in the area sense something's wrong. Sometimes up to 100 calls per minute for one terrorist. I've seen in certain areas. There was one fascinating one that it was a terrorist that came on Shabbos when nobody carries a phone in a from area, and still they got about 100 calls. That means that was the level of urgency, which in a way means that our body is reacting, our body is sensing, and something is telling us that something's wrong. And yet we see that many times we lose that sense. Many times we won't call it in because I don't want to look stupid. I don't trust myself. Maybe I'm making a mistake. Maybe I can't rely on this or whatever it is. How do we cover this gap? And, you know, now we have Julia, you as a therapist, and Michael from the operations side, as well as Karen from what you're seeing, to cover this gap between when somebody has a sensation, to be aware of your feeling, be aware and not to hesitate and to actually call it in, because it's okay if you're wrong. But generally, you're not wrong, actually. Michael, go ahead.
Sure, thank you. Very good question, very interesting, close to my heart. In terms of intuition, I strongly believe in the 25-odd years that I've been in the security industry that your intuition is never wrong. Intuitively, quite often what happens is you will get a sense or a feeling that something is amiss, and because of that feeling or that sense, you literally change your behavior. So you will change your body posture, you will look around, you will be more present in the environment, you will immediately show attention to the present moment and what's going on around you. And quite often just that behavior itself, or you parking in a safer area, or you changing the time you go to the bank, is enough to avert an incident that would have taken place. There is a concept called intent, which is, legally speaking, the direction of your will with the knowledge that it is going to be wrong. But from an emotional perspective, that intent that is surrounds the commission of violence, specifically violence, is a sensation that if you are alert and present in the moment, in the present mind, and you are practicing situational awareness, you will perceive something tangible. It's the same reason why in sniper school, for example, they will tell you not to look at the target directly in the eyes, but rather look at the target through the crosshairs and focus on the sight picture rather than the individual, because quite often when you focus on the target, that individual immediately becomes aware that something is amiss. And so all of us have this natural emotional defensive mechanism that's very difficult to explain, but incredibly obvious in terms of a lot of people have a preemptive feeling before something bad happens. And it's very much learning the language of that intuition. Does it come to you in a dream? Does it come to you in a feeling like goosebumps? Does it come to you in a sense or in a joke that someone makes in passing? Does it come just as a feeling of dis-ease, a feeling of worry that is free-floating and not easy to identify? But very often, even in our environments, when you speak to our residents, people are aware before time that something isn't right. And so I always say, listen to your intuition, do not doubt it, and just take normal preventative and precautionary actions around it and literally act on that message that you have, which is kind of like a gift, you know.
So trust your intuition.
Trust your
anything.
Intuition. Trust it 100%.
Karim, is that something that you also see, that sometimes people maybe find themselves in the middle of a corruption situation that they were pulled into, and they could tell you afterwards, you know, from the beginning I felt something was wrong, something wasn't right, something I should have said, but I didn't have any evidence or anything, so I kept quiet?
Yeah, I think you get all sorts of different situations like that. You know, unfortunately, you even get situations where, you know, in terms of people's intent, you know, they were actually somehow complicit in something, and then they, you know, it got out of control, or it got bigger than they realized, and then they realize the implications of it, and then they, you know, they feel that they want to speak out. And I think that's oftentimes what silences people is the a feeling that they're complicit. But you know, if you, you know, not all whistleblowers have completely clean hands, but that doesn't mean that we still don't, you know, tell people that they you know, that they should speak out, you know, even if you know, they were complicit at some stage, they know what's right and wrong, and you know, at some stage you have to, you know, you're going to have to call it out, you know, or go down with the offense.
So the same thing you're saying is basically be aware to what you feel and sense and realize and trust yourself. And from there, we can go to a much better place. We do need to take our next ad break. And then when we come back, we will continue more on this topic. We'll hear also from the therapeutical side of things. Karim, I just want to say thank you so much for being with us until now. Really fascinating, the work you're doing. And it actually is paying back, because part of the election results, I think, was people getting aware of what is happening and what can be done and where things are going wrong. So well done to you and your organization. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Quick break and we will be right back.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
101.9 Chai FM, Chai. We are back, and we are here in a fascinating discussion about crime. As we know, these days are days that we have to be extra careful, extra aware, and these are not our best times, so we definitely want to look around and be completely aware of what's happening. And right before the break, Michael mentioned as well of how strongly our instinct is and our intuition is, and how we need to be so careful and so aware of what's happening, and don't underestimate your ability to predict. It doesn't mean you're a psychic. It doesn't mean you're have delusional. We have a inner intuition that tells us when something is safe, something is not, and you must call it in. Julia, going to that, you as a trauma therapist, do you see a difference when people who have gone through trauma, when they've noticed before and reacted, or potentially they had a feeling before and they didn't react? Does that affect the recovery as well? Does that affect what they feel? How does that impact their lives?
Well, I think there can be, you know, if, God forbid, somebody's murdered or whatever, there can be that sense of feeling guilty, that survival guilt. I survived. I should have done this, or I could have done that. And a lot of people will sit saying, maybe I could have done something different. But the truth is that we are built for survival. So when our brain takes over and we go into survival mode, we actually have zero control over what our response is. So we don't even know exactly at the time how we're going to react. Maybe we will fight back. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll just freeze and acquiesce. So there's no right or wrong. Again, it's such an individual perception and reaction to what is happening. But to come back to talking about how one might process the crime, I like to think of it, even though it sounds paradoxical, as post-traumatic growth.
Okay.
When we've been through a trauma doesn't have to necessarily just be a bad experience. A trauma is something where you are completely overwhelmed. Your nervous system can't cope. And essentially, you are powerless, you are helpless, and there's nothing you can do.
Or at least you're overpowered.
Yeah, completely overpowered. And that's kind of what defines trauma. And it can be something that happens to you directly, or that you witness happening to someone else. And in fact, there can be vicarious or secondary trauma, which is often like moms will be on the phone talking to their friends and the kids are listening. And I always say, do not talk in front of the children because it will affect them. It is traumatic to hear these things. But to get back to post-traumatic growth, if we intervene with therapy. And it is vital to know there is help. You don't have to suffer. You can go and get help. And trauma therapy is short-term therapy. You're not going to spend 2, 3, 4 years. You're going to deal with what happened.
And one thing that's very important, it's never too late. I've had people that spoke to me and said, well, it happened 10 years ago. There's nothing I could do about it. It's not true. You could still improve your life 10 years later.
Absolutely. And
so, Julia, on what you said, I want to find the middle ground between when Michael says, okay, we need to have awareness, we need to know, we need to look, we need to teach our families, our communities, our children, and between you saying, well, if we overhear about crime, we'll create a trauma. What is the balance, and let's try to find it, of how much to educate our children, how much to discuss, how much to keep away from, where would you recommend to draw the line?
That's quite a difficult one, because it depends what the children might have witnessed and what they have heard and how much the community might be talking about it.
I'm talking about before an event happens.
Before an event. I think a way of empowering ourselves is to say, if I'm going out on my own and perhaps it's the nighttime, don't park somewhere dark. Don't leave your car outside. Maybe carry a pepper spray. Let the people know you're arriving. Get hold of CAP. There are a lot of ways you can empower yourself. If it's late at night, don't stop at a robot. I don't. I just look and I keep going because I don't want to be a sitting duck. So if it was a break-in and you couldn't anticipate it at home, maybe you want a higher wall, or you want to make sure your electric fence is working, or you want another gate, whatever it is that you feel.
So basically what you're saying, and you're giving a very clear direction, but the common denominator is to talk about what we can do and not to talk about what we can't do, and to see what are the things that we can do to make ourselves safer and protected and empower us to react and to do. And I want to take from that list to go over to Michael, and I want to share on a personal level. About, I don't know, 6, 7 years ago, in one of the shows, somehow the topic of trauma came in, and a psychologist, well-known psychologist in the community who was driving in the car, picked up her phone and called into the station, into the show, and she gave very clear guidance of what to do in case of an invasion. And I found it very interesting, but didn't think too much into it. About 2 months later, in the middle of the night, I had a home invasion. We had robbers broke into the house, held us up, me, my wife, my kids, throughout the night. Sure. And I'll forever be grateful to that therapist for the rest of my life that me and my wife knew exactly what to do and how to react and how to manage it. And we had a very clear direction. What are the things that you could recommend that are empowering that we can do as a community, besides for looking around as all the amazing things, and very correctly so, that Julia mentioned, but also things that when something does happen, because many times I'll do a trauma therapy for someone and they'll tell me 30 seconds before I realized it's way too late to do anything, but they did see. So what are the things we can do? But I will keep you waiting, and right after the break, we will go to the answer.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
101.9 Hi FM, Hi Chinuch. We are back. And right before the break, I asked Michael, what are the things we can do to empower ourselves to be prepared in a case of an event when it actually took place already, and we are now being overpowered, but we don't want to lose completely our power to manage the situation, which will affect the trauma and everything. What would you recommend?
Well, I'm going to take it back a step and say that your planning and your sort of preparation for any event in life is critical. So just like we like to plan for our holidays and we plan for our birthdays and we plan for retirement, very often we don't like to spend time or consideration or thought planning or considering what would happen if something went wrong. And so one of the really important things that any family can do in their home is have a basic plan for every eventuality in your home, whether it's a fire, whether it's a home invasion robbery, God forbid, whether it's a vehicle hijacking, whether it's a medical emergency, whatever that emergency is, quite often if you just visualize that emergency, take yourself through it, mind walk yourself through that event, and come to a positive outcome in your mind walk, in your visualization. Picture a positive result for you and your family, and then take that your family through it. We never want to encourage fear. We don't want to encourage people to respond with fear. We want people to respond with courageousness, with bravery, and with information. And so when you talk to your children around these things, rather, especially when they're young, make it in terms of a game, in terms of an instruction that creates some kind of an excitement when they get it right. Don't overwhelm them with the negativity that's surrounding us. Even when CAP shares a crime or incident information bulletin, we always do it in a way that what is empowering to the person that's reading that message. And then, according to your plan, adjust your physical security if necessary. If you feel your physical security isn't up to par, increase it. Give yourself the best fighting chance. Have security in and around your vehicle. Understand what to do in and around your vehicle. And when you're out there in public, what would you do if something went wrong right here, right now, even in this room? I have a plan. I've already thought about it. I've been sitting here for about 15, 20 minutes. I know what to do.
So, in other words, what you're saying is failing to plan is planning to fail.
Yes, sir.
And I think
good
that's
summation.
But that's exactly what you're saying in a very clear way. We do need to start it to wrap up and end the show. And I want to ask both of you, what do you hope that we know or we can do or wish for the community knowledge when it comes to your field of work that we will have a better future for our country and society? Michael.
Well, CAP loves South Africa. We literally, part of my job is to keep people from leaving South Africa in one way and staying in our beautiful country. We believe strongly in the future of our country for everyone, and we believe that everybody has the right to safety and security, and the only people that will ensure that that right is enshrined and given power, given light, is you, the individual, is for you to take your security seriously, to be responsible for your family and your community, and when you see something wrong, call it in, call us.
Amazing. Julia, what do you hope we know?
Well, it's been proven that the greater the family support, the greater the social support, and it can depend religious support as well, the better the outcome for the individual. And I think we've got a very cohesive community that works together. CAP makes sure that happens. And so the prognosis should be really good for us emotionally and psychologically. With all the help we've got in terms of therapy and knowing you can get help, knowing it's short term, and just being there for each other.
Our strength is in our unity and just pulling through and supporting each other, and if we all do what we can, it will be amazing. And I think from seeing the work you are doing at the professionals on the show, it's amazing to see, and obviously if we all learn from you and take that step forward, we will get to a much stronger and better place. So Julia, I'd like to thank you for being with us today and sharing this with us. Mike as well, thank you so much. Mike, you are from CAP.
Pleasure.
Julia, you're a trauma counselor and EMDR therapist. We had Karim as well from Crime Watch today. And just thank you all for helping us get the awareness and the knowledge that we have and need to be stronger and more protected, and let's stay safe these days. And please God, we can't say without that we all have our hearts overseas worrying for our siblings, for our families, and just please God, we should, by next show, we will all be celebrating and enjoying and happy and not even have to go through the horrific times and through Tisha B'Av. Stay safe. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you to Craig for managing the show perfectly. Thank you, Sana, for putting these interviews in place. And again, our listeners, thank you for being with us week after week. And we'll see you next week with our great new topic.